Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
One reason that USDA is forecasting a 21% drop in net cash income for farmers this year is because of
government payments declining a little over 34% year over year.
Big drop. This from USDA's chief economist, Seth Meyer. He says this is a couple of years in a row now for direct government payments declining. Meyer says the payments surrounding the pandemic are coming to a halt. Plus,
with high commodity prices, we see payments related to commodity prices decline as well, too. Right. So some of those payments that fluctuate with commodity prices, they're shrinking to quite low levels here and expected for 2023.
Total direct government payments to producers estimated to be $10.2 billion this year. It was $15.6 billion last year and over $27 billion in 2021. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The biggest issue right now is the 2023 Farm Bill.
Allison Rivera, Executive Director, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We are part of this larger lobby team at NCBA, but the priorities and the policies that we lobby on come directly from the grassroots, from our producer members. But, you know, as we look to this 2023 Farm Bill, we've certainly got our work cut out for us. We've got a ton of new members of Congress that have never voted on a Farm Bill, and we've really got to go get in there and educate them on why is this bill important, why is it important to our producers and their constituents. And so there's going to be a hefty price tag, and we recognize that. And we've got a lot of new members of Congress that have come in and run on, you know, being fiscally conservative. And so we've got to do a lot of educating. Some of that stuff we're going to talk about is the importance of the animal health provisions that we got in the 2018 Farm Bill, and the importance of maintaining that vaccine bank, those animal preparedness dollars, just to make sure that that our industry is protected and prepared in the case of a foreign animal disease outbreak like foot and mouth disease. Protecting that voluntary conservation programs. We have a lot of money out there. We want to make sure that it gets where it needs to go and that it benefits our producers. Also, in the last year, two, three, we've seen a huge uptick in the usage of risk management programs. And that's something that we want to continue to kind of help educate our members on, to take advantage of those programs like livestock risk protection and things like PRF, which we know that a lot of producers are using right now. And then disaster programs. You know, we've unfortunately seen a lot of weather events in the last couple of years and want to make sure that those programs work for our members. And if they need to be tweaked in this Farm Bill, we want to be able to do that. And lastly, again, this Farm Bill is going to be, you know, somewhat difficult to get across the finish line for lots of different reasons. We don't want to muddy the waters by adding a livestock title. We don't need a livestock title. There's a lot of conversations and a lot of spaces in the livestock industry, and you know, maybe that is better done outside of a Farm Bill, and that's where we want to keep it, outside of the Farm Bill.
She talks about funding the Farm Bill.
There are certainly some mandatory dollars that come with the vaccine bank in particular, and so that's good. But, you know, I think there's a need for a little bit more, and it is going to be a little bit of a challenge. Again, we have a lot of members that we need to educate on authorizing and appropriating dollars and programs and kind of how that, you know, where those needs lie. And again, I think we're starting the uphill battle with this Farm Bill, and it might take a little bit of time, but you know, we've got a lot of great allies on House Ag Committee. We've got Chairman Thompson, who we're just excited to work with, and he knows the drill and he knows how to get it done. We've got former Chairman Lucas coming back to the House Ag Committee, and we're super excited about that. And obviously we have a lot of friends on the Senate side as well. So you know, trying to gather those dollars is going to be difficult, but we can get it done.
Yet ag will be fighting the idea of a $1 trillion farm bill.
It's probably not lost on a lot of people, a lot of your listeners, that SNAP is the largest portion. I think it's going to be about 80% of the total spending. It makes it difficult. You know, Chairman Thompson has a lot of thoughts in that SNAP space, and has some experience with the program growing up, and brings a lot of wisdom and thoughts and how we can work on that issue. We don't have a ton of policy in the SNAP space, but we know that the SNAP portion and the farm portion have to go together. We've seen in the past that it's just difficult to separate the two and get it across the finish line. So we will figure out how to tackle that and move forward for sure.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So U.S. corn exports set a record in 2021 at 69 million metric tons.
Ryan LeGrand is president and CEO of the U.S. Grains Council.
And the top five markets in the recently completed 21-22 crop year include Canada, Japan, Colombia, and China, totaling just over 62 million metric tons. And while we're off to a bit of a slow start in the current marketing year, with low water levels on the Mississippi slowing initial shipments, there are still bright spots for U.S. corn. Both Mexico and China have been shipping the new crop corn they have purchased. And Central American markets are coming in strong in the early stages of this current year. Honduras and Guatemala make the top five, with Costa Rica, El Salvador, and Panama not too far behind them. So corn is not the only commodity for which we develop overseas markets. U.S. sorghum is an ancient grain, high in protein, and the U.S. is the world's largest producer of it. The U.S. had nearly 7.5 million metric tons of total exports in the 21-22 crop year, up by nearly 500,000 tons the prior year. China, our biggest buyer, held steady at 6.5 million metric tons, but we saw Mexico and Spain buy larger quantities of U.S. sorghum in the past year. So while China may hold the key to buying U.S. sorghum again this year, the U.S. is always prepared to work with countries like Mexico, like Spain, and others in current and subsequent crop years. U.S. distillers grains, or DDGS, as many of you know, are a highly valuable product, and our ethanol plants have perfected production and drying techniques to increase consistency and quality of this product. Distillers grains exports totaled 11.6 million tons in 2021, an improvement over 2020 and the third largest annual volume on record. We had nearly as much exported in 2022 at just over 11.5 million tons. Distillers grains were exported to over 50 countries, with Mexico, Vietnam, South Korea, Canada, and Indonesia rounding out the top five markets, proving that the world places a high value on this superior product. Beyond price, which is always a good place to start, buying U.S. corn, sorghum, and DDGS has many advantages. Our system offers transparency in pricing. No matter where you are in the world, you can find the price for U.S. commodities. We offer reliable delivery, so there's minimal delay in receiving your shipments. U.S. origin grain and co-products are subject to rigorous inspection by an independent surveyor from the Federal Grain Inspection Service on site. So if it doesn't make spec, it doesn't ship. And the United States, through commodity groups like ours, the U.S. Grains Council, offers customer servicing and technical assistance to any buyers anywhere. The Council also offers corn and sorghum quality data from both the field when it's harvested and from the port just prior to export. We've been collecting this data for more than 11 years, and we make it available to potential buyers so they can compare this year's crop to those of past years to help determine the crop quality they will be receiving. And as I hope you've already seen in your time with us here in the U.S., we offer a diverse range of products that help build efficiencies with bulk shipments. We can create combined shipments of feed ingredients, including U.S. corn, DDGS, sorghum, corn gluten meal, and more. Global container shipping, as we've seen, has seen major disruptions throughout the pandemic. But as Jay just mentioned in his presentation, rates are starting to improve. Hopefully, availability of containers is not too far behind that. And the U.S. remains the most reliable container shipping hub for agricultural products in the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
If we think about the dairy cow side, particularly the beef on dairy, and then our estimate, this is looking at the calf crop out of the dairy herd that would be beef on dairy cross in the rearview mirror. And you can see that it's trending higher at a very fast rate.
Kevin Good with Cattle Facts speaking at the Cattle Facts Annual Outlook Seminar in New Orleans.
If you just think about a year and a half lag when they're born to when they're harvested, it would suggest that this past year, about 7% of the cattle we harvested would have been beef on dairy cross in the fed mix. And if we continue this trend over the next couple years, potentially by 25 and 26, it could amount for 15% or more. So it really is a big game changer as we think about beef production in the U.S., not only where it's coming from, but probably more of the consistency, too, because from a long-term perspective, we are going to suggest that the dairy herd does continue to gradually increase. If you think about the drivers there, milk values this past year held together very nicely, supported by record exports, both dollar-wise and also percentage. About 20% of the milk value is exported today. And then think about the profitability from the beef on dairy cross. That's another profit center for the dairy industry, as well as sex semen usage to produce their female as a cost saving from that standpoint. So it's a win-win as we think about that industry. More than likely, they will continue to have a slow march into larger supplies as we go forward. So the beef on dairy issue is going to continue to be bigger. We're going to continue to use more and more in our harvest mix.
And for feeder cattle?
If we think about that feeder cattle supply outside of feed yards, we utilized a record high percentage this past year. I think we need to recognize the drought pulled those feeder cattle supplies forward throughout the year. And with that said, here we are the first of this year on a balance sheet. It would suggest that the total feeder cattle and calf supply totally is down about 1.3 million head. If you broke that down in all feed yard sides, it would be down about 520,000 head. Outside of feed yards, it'd be down roughly 750,000 head. And so you got less cattle on feed as we start talking about production for this year, and you've got a smaller bucket to place, which would suggest as we go forward, not only the first half, but the numbers for placements in the first half of this year will translate into tighter supplies all the way through the second half of this year. Remembering that we are a North American market, both cattle and beef flow north and south, we have seen some changes the last couple of years. Substantially less feeder cattle have came in from Mexico. Last year and the year prior, both years, about a 300,000 head drop each year. I think it's important to note that the feeding industry in Mexico has expanded. They're harvesting more cattle, and in turn, they're exporting us more beef. If we looked at that trend from 2010, we imported 100 million pounds of beef from Mexico. Today, that number is going to be 700 million plus. And so more of those cattle generally are going to stay south of the border, and we're going to bring more product in as we go forward. And it's important to recognize in Canada, they really haven't had a cattle cycle since BSE. They've been flat to declining since then. So if they're going to keep their shackle space going and their pen space going, their shackle space utilized, it is going to mean that more of those cattle more than likely will stay north of the border as we go forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, we've been trending up for the last 2 years, really coming out of 2020. Cattle markets have improved. That trend is well in place. We expect that to continue.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
Now, you know, short term, yeah, we can see some ups and downs, weather issues this time of the year. So we got, you know, several more months here where we can have weather impacts on, you know, both feeder and fed cattle markets, maybe more so on fed cattle. But if you can't truck them around, you can't move cattle, then weather impacts are an impact. But that doesn't change the fact that the underlying numbers are tighter. The overall situation from a supply fundamental standpoint is going to continue to support this market. And so we've definitely got expectations for, you know, stronger prices for these calves, feeder cattle, you know, whether it's lightweight calves, stocker type calves, or the bigger feeder cattle on into the fed cattle market.
The industry changed 10 years ago.
The packing industry in this country, most of that infrastructure that we rely on for the bulk of our slaughter was built in the 70s and 80s, early 80s. And that was a time period when we had 20 to 25 million more head of cattle than we do today, just from the long-term adjustments in the industry. So there was chronic excess capacity in that industry for, you know, the most producers today can't remember a time when that wasn't the case. And that's what made that such a change. After, you know, we had closed a couple of plants earlier, but that last plant that closed at Plainview in 2013 really brought the total capacity down to a level where then we were in a drought and we bottomed in 2014. the expansion that followed that, by 2016 to 2017, cattle numbers were back up enough where now, for the first time maybe ever, we were really bumping up against that slaughter capacity. That creates different dynamics in the industry. Obviously, it changes, the negotiation, if you will, between buyers and sellers. And that's something we had just not ever really seen before. So that was a big, big change for us.
When we start to rebuild, who takes that risk?
You know, I think there's no doubt that we're going to see, significant incentives to rebuild. The last drought, which, numbers bottomed in 2014, we were smaller than we needed to be. The market really said we were bigger than that, and that's what provided the motivation for the kind of cattle prices we had in 2014 and 15 to jumpstart and spur that expansion. We're going to see something like that again. With the numbers we just got from USDA for 2023, we're smaller than we need to be. And we're not sure yet whether the drought's over. So we're not sure exactly when we start this process of rebuilding, but it is going to happen. If not in 2023, then after that, at some point in time, we're going to see something like that again. And we had never seen it before 2014 and 15. So I do think there are some lessons to kind of learn. We learned that cattle prices can go much higher maybe than we really anticipated. I think we'll see that again. And because of the general trend in things, they'll go even higher than they did last time. There's almost no doubt of that. How much higher is a different question. But they also didn't stay up there very long. You have to have those prices to jumpstart that expansion. They didn't stay too long, and when you look at the female market, cows and heifer prices went phenomenally high. We bought those cows, and then it turns out that we couldn't pay for them. The market didn't really stay long enough to pay for them. So I think we need to think about that as an industry, but especially as individuals, of sort of who's going to play this game. And I say it's a game. It's deadly serious business in terms of who's really in the best financial condition to be a part of this ride up, because we're not sure how long it lasts before we start the backside of this thing. And we probably ought to think about that a little more maybe than we did 10 years ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In 2000, consumers hit a high at 60% saying they would pay more for better quality garments.
Kim Kitchens is Senior Vice President, Consumer Marketing with Cotton Incorporated.
However, that was right at the time of fast fashion came into the marketplace. We started to see this directly impacted by the opportunity to pay less for garments, cheaper garments, and then dispose of them. So that number went down, and it hit a low in 2011 of 45%. However, since that time, we have seen an attitudinal shift among consumers and somewhat of a move away from some fast fashion. Today, in 2022, we are at a 15-year high of 52% of consumers saying, yes, I'm willing to pay more for quality. This number is exceptionally important as we potentially go into a recessionary period, definitely high inflation, and what's occurring. Consumers are going to have to get more for their money when buying apparel because it's a discretionary purchase. And not only do we know that consumers say they'll pay more for quality, 73% say that cotton clothing is the highest quality that they can buy and that it lasts the longest. And this chart, we can see where consumers told us 65% said cotton clothing lasts the longest, period. That's three times more than clothing from polyester and then rayon. And again, this is attitudinal. It's what they're saying subjectively and what they believe to be true. But we always like to see, what do they do? Because what you tell us sometimes is not what maybe actually happens. So we went in 2020, before the pandemic, we went into consumers' closets. And we had done this study many years ago as well to understand what was in their closet. But in 2020, we went in and we wanted to look at the clothing they had kept the longest and that they wear most often. What was the fiber content? And when you looked at that, the average fiber content of the oldest clothing items in their closet was 61% cotton. You can see the other fiber content there. Of those items, the 61% that contained cotton, 44% of those were 100% cotton. So cotton lasts longer. Not only did it last longer, it lasted about a year and a half longer than garments made from synthetic fibers in their closet. That's significance. That's durability. That's sustainability. You see how we start to put these messages together and how they can be relevant and resonate to consumers.
So what's a label worth?
Textile certification and the awareness there, because there are many labels out at retail today, but consumers aren't that familiar. The number one label they recognize when looking at textile certification among these is USDA Organic. And that started in the early 2000s. And as many of you are familiar with, I'm sure it was on food and other places. So consumers have seen that. It makes sense they're aware of that. But these other certifications that you look at, they're not aware of, and they don't really know what they mean either. And we showed them the symbols to see to make certain cases that pictorial. But while they don't know what that means, we know that more than 8 out of 10 consumers are aware and recognize the silk of cotton. And that's been true for decades. But not only are they aware that it represents cotton content, cotton containing items, 82% say that products with the silk of cotton are sustainable. We know that 85% of consumers would like to see more silk of cottons on products to help give them that nod. And that 80% of consumers say a brand using this logo cares about the environment. Now, next year in 2023 will be our 50th anniversary of the silk of cotton and the logo. Any way you look at it, for the cotton industry, the silk of cotton is sustainable.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As expected, all cows and heifers that have calved total 38.3 million head, also nearly 3% below last year, reflecting 4% fewer beef cows at 28.9 million head and just a slight uptick in dairy cows. That's the smallest beef cow inventory since 1962.
Dr. Jason Franken is an agricultural economist at Western Illinois University.
As further evidence of continued contraction, beef replacement heifers are down about 6% from a year ago, compared to an average pre-report estimate of only 3% lower, while dairy replacement heifers and other heifers are down 2% and 3% respectively. Overall, the inventory of all heifers weighing 500 pounds or more is down about 4% compared to expectations for just a 2% decline. Steers and bulls weighing 500 plus pounds are down 3% and 4% respectively, while the number of calves under 500 pounds is also down about 3%. With around 3% fewer cows and heifers calved, the USDA has revised downward the July estimate of the 2022 calf crop to 34.5 million head, so that it is now 2% below the 2021 level, which will further limit the number of animals on feed and beef production in 2023 and 24. The USDA's most recent cattle on feed report indicates over 11.7 million head on feed, or just about 3% less than on January 1st of last year. Last December, feedlots also placed 1.8 million cattle on feed, or about 8% fewer than a year earlier, and marketed 1.74 million, or about 6% less. The mix of steers and heifers indicates that compared to a year ago, more heifers are being sent to feedlots instead of staying on farm as breeding stock. Steers on feed are down about 4.5%, while heifers are down only 0.5% from a year ago, such that heifers now comprise 39.8% of animals in feedlots, or 1% more than a year ago, compared to only 31 to 33% during much of the last expansion. This is additional evidence that producers have no plans to expand the brood cow herd. In light of the smaller inventory and cattle on feed numbers, beef production is anticipated to be 6.5% lower in 2023 than last year. Lower availability of beef is expected to constrain U.S. per capita beef consumption to about 56.3 pounds per person in 2023, compared to more than 59 pounds per person in 2022, or around 5% lower. Meanwhile, exports are projected to be 13% lower this year, which also reflects lower anticipated beef production and the strong beef exports we've seen in recent years. All things considered, prices in 2023 are shaping up to exceed those of the last couple of years. In fact, current conditions are even bringing about speculation on the possibility of exceeding record prices last set in the fourth quarter of 2014. That seems feasible for fat cattle, which are already trading around $9 a hundredweight more than in the first quarter of 2014. Here, quarterly prices for slaughter steers are forecast to average about $157.39 a hundredweight, $160.81 a hundredweight, $161.81 a hundredweight, and $166.40 a hundredweight, respectively. This forecast assumes lower quarterly price growth in 2014 because a longer transition into herd expansion is anticipated due to the lack of potential replacement heifers, uncertainties about inflation and interest rates, and competition from pork, poultry, and imported beef. It is also likely that feeder prices may spike above 2014 record levels once producers shift to retaining heifers for herd rebuilding, thereby limiting placements on feed. on feedlots. However, again, herd rebuilding is anticipated to be delayed compared to 2014. With the expectation that herd rebuilding is well more than a year off, and given that 600 to 700 pound feeders are currently trading around $191 a hundredweight, surpassing records which averaged about 257 a hundredweight and ranged as high as the 270s in the fourth quarter of 2014, we'll likely have to wait another year, or maybe two.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In his Tuesday night speech, President Biden declared,
"The State of the Union is strong.
And we're here today to ensure that it continues to strengthen."
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking Wednesday to an audience at North Carolina A&T University, talking about a number of initiatives aimed at strengthening the farm and rural economy. One big one, helping farmers adopt climate smart practices and profit from producing climate smart products. Vilsack said, yes, adopting those practices will likely cost money and take expertise that most producers don't have.
So the Department of Agriculture, working in partnership with a variety of other folks, including great universities like this one, will basically provide the resources to allow you to embrace climate smart practices and then work with markets that are ready, willing, and able to pay for those climate smart commodities. Why? Because their customers are asking for it.
Vilsack said there are 141 such climate smart pilot projects now going on across the country. Gary Crawford, Washington.